This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jeff Bossert. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Henry Frain. For today's program, we're going to examine presidential campaign rhetoric from 100 years ago. It's an age when candidates did not make campaign speeches before the public, and it's hard to say when they may have started had it not been for the efforts of a Democrat who made three attempts at the nation's top office. I'm talking about William Jennings Bryan, who lost three contests in 1896, 1900, and 1908. In that last campaign, he and Republican opponent and eventual winner William Howard Taft agreed to take advantage of new technology. For the first time, voters could hear the voices of their candidates through recordings on Edison cylinders. A new CD entitled Debate 08 consists of the original speeches done by Taft and Bryan. These two-minute addresses marked a first in a generation with no TV or radio. The CD was released by Archaeophone Records. The Champaign-based label was founded in 1998. It's responsible for preserving and distributing public domain work from the industry's acoustic era, or recordings from the 1880s through 1925. Archaeophone is a Grammy winner. It took the award for Best Historical Album last year for Lost Sounds, Blacks in the Birth of the Recording Industry. The label also received a Grammy nomination this past year for Actionable Offenses, a series of obscene recordings from the 1890s. As time permits, we may have some time to discuss the studio and some of the work that Archaeophone has done, as I just mentioned, but we're mainly here to discuss the latest release about 1908's presidential campaign. Today's guests are Richard Martin. He's the co-founder of Archaeophone Records and a producer of Debate 08 with wife Megan Hennessy. They market more than 40 themed collections of audio on CD, ranging from early vaudeville artists, jazz and blues, old comedy routines, and speech, each including extensive write-ups about the artists. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Jeff.
And joining us by phone is Patrick Feaster. He's a phonograph historian and instructor in the Department of Communication and Culture at Indiana University. He was a collaborator on Debate 08. He did the album notes for the CD. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you aboard. Before we listen to the speeches, I thought maybe we could start by providing some background and context, sort of set the framework for the political arena 100 years ago. I wonder if we could talk about the two candidates and what they had in common, because it seems like they didn't have a great deal other than maybe a background in law. William Jennings Bryan was called the Great Commoner, also known for his speech-giving ability out on the Chautauqua Circuit. Meanwhile, you have William Howard Taft, who served under William McKinley in various roles, including chairman of a commission to organize a government in the Philippines. He was also Secretary of War under Theodore Roosevelt. A few years later, also acting Secretary of State for a while. Quite a bit of research, Patrick Feaster, because you did the extensive album notes for this.
I wrote one of the essays at the beginning of the booklet. It was came out of some work I did here at Indiana University for my dissertation, which had to do with early uses of the phonograph. This being, of course, one of the more interesting cases of that. Looking into this particular campaign, it has really led to a lot of connections with what's going on today, perhaps more than a lot of other things I looked at. It's that every moment you'd be looking at some detail from what was going on in 08 and think, you know, that's going on still, now, today, and yet we take it completely for granted. Yet here it was new, exciting. That's been my thrill throughout this project.
Edison built the phonograph first in 1877 and needed some time to perfect it. By 1892, it started to have a role in the election by promoting campaign songs. And then a few years later, speeches were recorded by candidates. At one point around there, did Edison begin to see, I should record the speeches of candidates? This would be a remarkable way for the public to hear the voices of those running for office.
Well, people have been speculating about that from the very beginning. As soon as you've got a machine that can record and reproduce people's speech, of course you'll think about what kinds of speech exists out there, what could you do with it if you could can it, bottle it, sell it, send it out, and so on. And people were a little torn. There's kind of a love-hate relationship with political rhetoric in this country. On the one hand, people were saying how great it would be. You'd record political speeches by our foremost orators, you'd preserve them for all time, and this would be just wonderful. Their personalities would live on. On the other hand, you had people thinking, well, this is going to be great. You can actually make congressmen listen to their own speeches for a change. Maybe instead of paying politicians to work now, we can just buy a bunch of phonographs and run them in Congress instead. So the idea itself was dated back very, very early. But in terms of actually doing it, there are a number of technical obstacles in the way. How you exactly make lots of copies of a recording was a big technical challenge, more so than we might think. But just the whole idea itself was a little unsettling for people. Sure, you can record someone speaking and then you can play it back, but what are the limits and what you can really do with that? What's proper? For instance, if you record a preacher doing a wedding ceremony, can you use that cylinder then to marry people? So, you know, using a phonograph to do political speaking for somebody was something that took a little getting used to. People weren't quite sure what they thought of that.
And the whole concept of public appearances was not a big thing then either. This was something I think that William Jennings Bryan really started to run with.
Yeah, he was really breaking the trend when he went around in 96, trying to appear before the public to make a case for himself as president. This just wasn't something that presidential candidates did. Other candidates did. Gubernatorial candidates did, local candidates certainly, but the presidency was something a little more remote, a little more special. That was the dignity of the office just seemed to preclude anyone doing anything quite like that.
What really struck me is the first campaign speeches you could purchase on these Edison cylinders were done by voice actors, reenactments of the speeches.
Right. A few different reasons for that. The main one being that you really couldn't make that many copies of a recording easily during this period. For various technical reasons, you really had to make a record over and over and over again from an original performance if you were going to make enough of them to sell on any scale. So if you were going to offer political speeches to the public, you'd have to hire someone to stay in your studio pretty much all day, every day doing that. And if you're running for president of the United States, that is not going to be a very appealing thing to do. On the other hand, there's an assumption today. If I said, here, I'm going to give you a recording of a speech by Franklin Roosevelt or whoever, you'll assume, well, that's their actual voice. But back in this period, people were really not sure what direction that might take. Or they didn't really have expectations of authenticity in the way that we would today. So the idea of a reenactment of a historical episode may have seemed to them a little bit more like a Hollywood movie today, the reenacting something from the Civil War. It wasn't really that they were fooling anybody by passing off speeches, you know, that were actually done by actors and yet it's supposed to be McKinley or some other candidate. It was really more about giving people a particular kind of experience. You could sort of imagine that you were there listening to a speech, and to push that even further, they would imitate the sounds of the audience in the background. You'd have the person doing the speech, and there in the background, there would be people yelling, "Hooray! Yeah, you tell them!" And so on, to the point that today, when people listen to these, they often think they were parodies. They were actually intended as comedy, but no, at the time, it was really meant very seriously.
Well, there's probably a few that didn't know they weren't listening to the real thing.
Probably so. Particularly when you were carrying phonographs around and charging a nickel a listen, it was very much in the interest of the person who had the phonograph to make you think it was the real thing.
We're talking with Patrick Feaster over at Indiana University and Richard Martin from Archaeophone Records. They both worked on Debate 08, the new release from Archaeophone Records. Just came out, and it's got campaign speeches from William Jennings Bryan and William Howard Taft. And people could, for the first time, could hear the voices of their presidential candidates. Now, the first time Bryan tried doing this, the idea fell through because of some kind of legal disputes over financing of the project?
That's right. It's a little fuzzy yet. This isn't widely known, and the sources are really just coming together. But apparently there was a company that had the rights to use the phonograph for politics in that campaign. Someone had bought the rights to do that from one of the main companies. And allegedly, the company leaned Republican, so that when the Democrats made arrangements to use a phonograph, And then problems arose. They blamed it on politics. The company, on the other hand, said they just didn't pay their bills.
Well, why don't we jump ahead? I've got a whole lot of questions for both of you, but let's listen to some of the campaign audio. By the way, if you have a call about the technology of this era, the presidential campaign, we'll happily take your calls for Richard Patrick at 333-9455 or outside of the immediate area, our toll-free number 800-222-9455. We're going to go to the first address that we have lined up here. It's from William Jennings Bryan. This was actually a text taken from an acceptance speech he made when he was nominated for president in 1900. This is An Ideal Republic off Debate 08.
An Ideal Republic by William Jennings Bryan, Edison Record. I can conceive of a national destiny surpassing the glories of the present and the past, a destiny which meets the responsibilities of today and measures up to the possibilities of the future. Behold a republic resting securely upon the foundation stone quarried by revolutionary patriots from the mountain of eternal truth, a republic applying in practice and proclaiming to the world the self-evident propositions that all men are created equal, that they're endowed with inalienable rights, that governments are instituted among men to secure these rights, and that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. Behold a republic in which civil and religious liberty stimulate all to earnest endeavor, and in which the law restrains every hand uplifted for a neighbor's injury. A republic in which every citizen is a sovereign, but in which no one cares to wear a crown. Behold a republic, standing erect while empires all around are bowed beneath the weight of their own armaments. A republic whose flag is love, while other flags are only fear. Behold a republic, increasing in population, in wealth, in strength, and in influence, solving the problems of civilization and hastening the coming of a universal brotherhood. A republic which shakes thrones and dissolves aristocracies by its silent example, and gives light and inspiration to those who sit in darkness. Behold a republic, gradually but surely becoming the supreme moral factor in the world's progress and the accepted arbiter of the world's disputes. A republic whose history, like the path of the just, is as the shining light that shineth more and more unto the perfect day.
That was William Jennings Bryan's speech, An Ideal Republic, sort of like his introductory speech for this 1908 presidential campaign, one of many Edison cylinder recordings that the public could buy and listen to in the comfort of their own homes on the Edison phonograph. We're talking about Debate 08, the new release from Archaeophone Records that features all these campaign speeches. And when I pose a question to either or both of my guests, Richard Martin and Patrick Feaster, about this audio, there have been other collections released before, but I guess this is the first time that we've been able to actually hear all 44 minutes of speech all at once.
Right. Some of the discs that Bryan and Taft made around the same time have been available here and there, and one or two of the cylinders again spotted here and there, but never all of the cylinders in one place. There were 10 cylinder recordings by Bryan and 12 by Taft, and what's special about them is that they were the first. Edison was the first company to get to the candidates and persuade them to make these recordings, and they were the first time that the candidates were forced to edit themselves. You know, they're used to giving extended speeches. The one you just played, An Ideal Republic, is a much longer speech that Bryan edited for the two-minute format of the wax cylinder. So for the first time, you really get these sort of sound bites, early century sound bites, where the candidates are forced to get to the point, distill their message, and make a powerful point to the listener.
Yeah, that's something else you brought up, was the fact that they had 2 minutes to work this time in. I mean, you have some notes, Patrick, in the book here, the accompanying debate await about the first session that Brian had with the National Phonograph Company. And I wonder if you can talk about the account of what happened. It mentioned their wax shavings all over the floor, about him, I assuming, screwing up a lot and having to go through several takes to get it right.
Right. Now, as you mentioned earlier, he had tried this once before, back in 1900, and it fell through for reasons that were really outside of his control. But one of the first things that occurred when he was asked to do this, he had an idea for how long he was supposed to make these speeches for the phonograph based on what he had done back in 1900, so he came up with these manuscripts that he thought were pruned to the right length, except he thought he had to deliver a speech that was about 3 minutes. Just because of some changes in the technology, the time had actually gone down since 1900. You couldn't talk for quite as long. So the first time he tried making a record, ran out of cylinder. And so he had to go back and change his manuscript to the right length. There are all sorts of little glitches that came up through the recording situation. This was at his house. They'd actually taken the phonograph out there to his own library to record him. And there were workmen actually hammering away on the porch out front. And they had to tell them to stop hammering because, couldn't really explain why, because this was apparently still a little hush-hush. So he said he was talking on the telephone. But in fact, according to the written accounts, at least, I couldn't hear them on the actual cylinder, but according to the written accounts, there are actually a few noises of hammering in the background on some of the cylinders.
And another problem that came from these was, once you make a recording, it's etched in stone. And if somebody changed something about their policy or the party changed directions, or I guess one specific example is Taft and Roosevelt parted ways a few years after some recordings for this campaign, for this presidential campaign, were made.
Right. In fact, Brian, at least, ended up updating a number of his selections. As Richard said, Edison was the first person to go out and record either candidate. But the two other leading companies of the time, Victor and Columbia, followed a little bit later. And by the time they made their records, the campaign had been going for a while. Things had developed a little bit further. The Republicans had adopted a platform. He tweaked things a little bit. But yeah, the real kicker was that Taft, in 1908, was an ardent supporter of Roosevelt, was assuring the public that he would carry on Roosevelt's policies. Roosevelt's the guy, and so on and so forth. Well, then in 1912, Roosevelt threw his hat back into the ring as a third-party candidate, running against Taft, and yet there were these records sitting around from 4 years before where he was saying what a wonderful person Roosevelt was. And, there were some amusing letters to the editor pointing this out.
And there were other companies that eventually gave the candidates a little more flexibility, I think up to maybe 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah, it was just a matter of what format you had available. Discs gave you a lot more latitude in terms of length. You can make a disc bigger and bigger in terms of diameter. A cylinder, just physically, you can't do much more with. In 1912, then they did have 4 minutes also on cylinder, I believe, just because the formats had changed by that point. So, yeah, things were changing very, very quickly. It must have been tough for them to keep up.
We're taking calls. If you'd like to chime in with a question for Richard Martin or Patrick Feaster from Archaeophone Records, we're talking about Debate 08, wax cylinder recordings made 100 years ago during the presidential campaign. I want to talk a bit about the rhetoric involved here, too. This was something like we'd mentioned that William Jennings Bryan really ran with, but it took some finagling to get Mr. Taft to agree to the same thing.
There were a lot of reasons why you would have avoided making a phonograph record, and the big one here wasn't so much the hassle of doing it, although as we know it involved having your living room full of wax shavings and having to edit yourself down and so forth. It was just the whole idea was considered a little undignified, and there are a number of reasons for that. There were other political speeches on record you could buy at this point, but they weren't made by presidential candidates. In fact, they weren't really made by candidates at all. They were made by vaudeville performers imitating candidates for comic effect, mainly bumbling candidates who made speeches that didn't make a lot of sense, have jeering from the audience and so forth. So the whole idea of having a campaign speech on record already had a little connotation of humor and belittlement. But there was a whole long discussion before this point about how politics connected with this idea of a machine that would speak and talk. I mean, that was the sort of politician you didn't want to be considered, a talking machine, someone who just got up in front of an audience and reeled off phrases. So this phrase, so-and-so is a talking machine, a phonograph, or more, that so-and-so is this other guy's phonograph, that he just parrots what this other person says all the time. These were really objectionable things to say about a candidate. So as soon as a candidate steps up and does this, he's giving the other side a lot of fodder to attack him with. When a word comes up inadvertently in a campaign, it can trigger all sorts of unexpected associations, lipstick on a pig being one recent example. But at this point, there were a lot of negative associations with the idea of connecting the phonograph in politics and with so much writing on little nuances of public opinion. This was something, you know, to be handled with caution.
Now, but they weren't necessarily done in response to one another. Like Taft did not record his or consent to record, or correct me if I'm wrong, but consent to record these as in response to what he'd already heard Mr. Bryan do.
The individual titles don't appear to be exact responses, although they could be used that way, and we'll probably talk about that a little bit later. But really, the Taft's final agreement to go ahead with this, I think, was largely due to just not wanting to give the other side a leg up. Now that Bryan, in 1908, had actually done it, his cylinders were going all around the country now. It was fun to use that to take pot shots at him, but, you know, there could be some advantage to this. It seemed to be going well, so there was a degree of copycatism there.
Yeah, you've got to remember, Bryan makes his records in May of 1908. He hasn't even been selected by the Democratic Convention yet as the candidate. But there was a sense that he would be. So Edison went ahead and did those ahead of time. Taft's recordings are in August, so there's 3 months in between. And Taft has just been confirmed by the Republicans in Cincinnati. And he did hear at least, you know, one or two. You know, they played him the kind of thing that Bryan had done. So he's got a sense of it. I mean, he's very green at this. Bryan had practiced, as we said, as early back as 1900. So he was at least familiar with it. Taft was not. Now, I think that when you hear these arranged like we've done it in a kind of a faux debate on the CD, you do get the sense that there is a bit of answering on the issues. But I think that, you know, whether Taft heard precisely what Bryan had done is immaterial because, of course, you know, the Republican positions are taking it fully into account. What Brian's been saying on the campaign trail.
We're taking your calls at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 if you'd like to ask a question about the 1908 presidential campaign or these audio cylinder recorded speeches that we're playing back for this program. I guess we'll move on to another William Jennings Bryan cut here. This is entitled Immortality. This was kind of radical and I think came to be known as the most popular Edison recording and also the personal favorite of William Jennings Bryan. Maybe our technical director could cue that one up. This is William Jennings Bryan and Immortality, the second one that we have lined up for today.
Immortality by William Jennings Bryan, Edison Records. If the Father deigns to touch with divine power the cold and pulseless heart of the buried acorn, and to make it to burst forth from its prison walls, will he leave neglected in the earth the soul of man, made in the image of his creator? If he stoops to give to the rose bush, whose withered blossoms float upon the autumn breeze, the sweet assurance of another springtime, will he refuse the words of hope to the sons of men when the frosts of winter come? If matter mute and inanimate, though changed by the forces of nature into a multitude of forms, can never die, will the spirit of man suffer annihilation when it has paid a brief visit, like a royal guest, to this tenement of clay? No, I am as sure that there is another life as I am that I live today. In Cairo, I secured a few grains of wheat that had slumbered for more than 3,000 years in an Egyptian tomb. As I looked upon them, this thought came into my mind. If one of those grains had been planted on the banks of the Nile the year after it grew, and if all its lineal descendants had been planted and replanted from that time until now, its progeny would today be sufficiently numerous to feed the teeming millions of the world. There is in the grain of wheat an invisible something that has power to discard the body that we see, and from earth and air fashion a new body so much like the old one that we cannot tell the one from the other. And if this invisible germ of life in the grain of wheat can thus pass unimpaired through 3,000 resurrections, I shall not doubt that my soul has power to clothe itself with a body suited to its new existence when this earthly frame has crumbled into dust.
Immortality, that's William Jennings Bryan giving a speech that seemed more like a sermon. This excerpt was taken from his Prince of Peace lecture. Not so much as a political statement, but as a window into his deep-seated faith-based beliefs, and apparently fairly very popular. Patrick Feaster.
Yes, it was. This was one of the speeches that he gave over and over and over again at Chautauquas, and it was really an example of him at his best as an orator. I mean, the reputations that these two candidates had were a bit different. William Jennings Bryan was considered a really good speaker, which may be one reason why it first occurred to people to sell his speeches on record. Taft was more from a lawyerly background. He wasn't so much a great eloquent public speaker. His forte was probably more the comic anecdote or the after-dinner speech and so on. But this was just a little brief excerpt from a speech that Bryan gave over and over again to audiences all around the country, so it was probably one of his most reusable compositions.
We're talking about Debate 08. This is the newest release from Archaeophone Records, the Champaign-based label. We're talking with Patrick Feaster, who is a collaborator on this project and wrote the album notes, and CD producer Richard Martin from Archaeophone. We welcome your calls at 333-9455. Champaign-Urbana area or on the outlying region, 800-222-9455. Let's move on to something that William Howard Taft had to say. This is the Republican and Democratic treatment of trusts. This originated from Taft's speech accepting the Republican nomination for president in Cincinnati in July of 1908. Here's William Howard Taft.
Republican and Democratic treatment of trusts by William H. Taft, Edison Records.
Unlawful trusts should be restrained with all the efficiency of injunctive process, and the persons engaged in maintaining them should be punished with all the severity of criminal prosecution in order that the methods pursued in the operation of their business shall be brought within the law. This is the Republican view. The Democratic platform proposes to take off the tariff on all articles coming into competition with those produced for the so-called trusts, and to put them on the free list. If such a course would be utterly destructive of their business as is intended, it would not only destroy the trust, but all of their smaller competitors. To destroy the trust and to eliminate the wealth they represent from the producing capital of the country would entail enormous loss and would throw out of employment myriads of working men and working women. Such a result is wholly unnecessary to the accomplishment of the needed reform, and will inflict upon the innocent far greater punishment than upon the guilty. The ruthless and impracticable character of the proposition grows plainer as its effects upon the whole community are realized. This difference between the policies of the two great parties is of especial importance in view of the present condition of business. Gradually, business is acquiring a healthier tone. Gradually, all wealth which was hoarded is coming out to be used. Confidence in security of business investments is a plant of slow growth and is absolutely necessary in order that our factories may all open again, in order that our unemployed may become employed, and in order that we may again have the prosperity which blessed us for 10 years. I submit to those most interested, to wage earners, to farmers, and to businessmen, whether the introduction into power of the Democratic Party with Mr. Bryan at its head and with the business destruction that it openly advocates as a remedy for present evils will bring about the needed confidence for the restoration of prosperity.
William Howard Taft, Republican and Democratic Treatment of Trusts. Patrick Feaster, a little more political, a little more meat in terms of something regarding business.
Yeah, that was actually taken directly from his speech accepting the Republican nomination in Cincinnati. Bryan really wrote all of his pieces, except for the two that we've heard. Most of the pieces that he came up with that pertained directly to issues of the election, he wrote specially for the phonograph. Not only that, he rewrote them every time a new company approached him. But Taft pretty much, with minor exceptions, took existing speeches word for word and just lifted sentences out of them. So that was the origin of that particular speech.
We'll go ahead, I think, and play the last one that we have here that we've queued up in our system. This was a way for the Republican platform to get away from what the party had suffered in the wake of the Brownsville affair. This is Rights and Progress of the Negro. This was William Howard Taft, recorded in 1908.
Rights and Progress of the Negro by William H. Taft, Edison Records.
The Republican platform refers to the amendments to the Constitution that were passed by the Republican Party for the protection of the Negro. The Negro, in the 40 years since he was freed from slavery, has made remarkable progress. He is becoming a more and more valuable member of the communities in which he lives. The education of the Negro is being expanded and improved in every way. The best men of both races at the North as well as at the South ought to rejoice to see growing up among the Southern people an influential element disposed to encourage the Negro in his hard struggle for industrial independence and assured political status. The Republican platform adopted at Chicago explicitly demands justice for all men without regard to race or color, and just as explicitly declares for the enforcement and without reservation in letter and spirit of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution. It is needless to state that I stand with my party squarely on that plank in the platform, and I believe that equal justice to all men and the fair and impartial enforcement of these amendments is in keeping with the real American spirit of fair play.
That was William Howard Taft, Rights and Progress of the Negro. And once again, we want to turn to our guest, Patrick Feaster, to talk about, I laid some groundwork for this before, but a speech that had to be done on the part of that party. Patrick?
Oh, yes, sorry.
That's all right.
Certainly. Actually, Richard, maybe you want to take that one because you devised that particular piece of the notes. I want to give you a chance to talk about that.
Yeah. Well, the you referenced the Brownsville affair in late 1906, and this was Brownsville, Texas. You had some racial tension down there between black troops, a regiment stationed at Fort Brown, and the local townspeople, and a conflict erupted. One man was left dead. And in the aftermath, it would appear to be, a frame-up. And rather than investigating it, Roosevelt dismissed three regiments of troops who always maintained their innocence. So there was a great deal of hard feelings from the African American community over that one, and there were some other things going on in the years right before the 1908 campaign that was that were threatening the expected historical allegiance of Black Americans to the Republican Party, which they had enjoyed since emancipation. This is really very interesting because you start to see African Americans pulling away from the Republican Party at this time, starting to head toward the Democrats a bit, and that only increases during Wilson's two terms in the teens. So Taft is here kind of trying to smooth ruffled feathers a bit and claiming that, the Republicans are firmly behind, progress for blacks and that they're the party that's going to take care of them.
Well, that wraps up the four pieces of speech I wanted to play, but I wanted to talk a bit more about this technology. We've talked a lot about the campaign rhetoric and the importance of these speeches. How many people do we have an idea how many people actually owned Edison cylinders? Is there any kind of gadget today that we can compare them to? For either of you, either of my two guests.
What do you think? Maybe a Blu-ray DVD player?
There are not too many of those out there yet.
But keep in mind, though, that you didn't actually have to own one of these machines to hear these records. If your neighbor had one, you'd probably hear it whether you wanted to or not. But in all likelihood, they'd have a kind of a gatherings on their porch at night in the summer, and you'd come out and listen to their records. That's, people played these over telephone exchanges and so on. So it wasn't just limited to people who actually owned the machines.
Yeah, you had phonograph debates conducted by dealers. So I suppose if somebody was really interested and you could pretend you were shopping for one and go in and listen to the two speeches being played back to back.
Yeah, this was a way to try to drum up business by Edison phonograph dealers where they would stage these debates in vaudeville halls. You've got the two mannequins, right? One is Bryan, one is Taft, and then the machine is playing the cylinder, and then you play the other guy's cylinder. So you've got this idea of a debate. These were apparently pretty popular, and there's art from the period depicting it with great amusement, and so that was one way that people could hear these political speeches without necessarily having to own them themselves.
Yeah, there's a lot of great one thing I want to point out too. I mean, this is the most correct me if I'm wrong, Richard, but the most extensive book you've put out with any of your CDs, or certainly one of the longest,
and it
lists the entire text of these speeches and a lot of cartoons and drawings from Harper's Weekly and other publications that accompanied this time. How popular, Patrick Feaster, can we surmise that these became, and what role or how much did they weigh? I mean, Bryan lost it was his worst loss of his presidential campaigns. So what role can we determine that these recordings played in actually putting out the vote?
You know, back at the time, that was the one thing that really nobody ended up speculating much about in the press, was how much, if any, effect did these have on the outcome of the election. People were really much more interested in the novelty of it and perhaps a little amused, a little frightened by the possibility it would affect the election. But I've really seen no evidence that this had an effect on the outcome of the election in any way at all. The cylinders themselves, it's a little hard to tell how well they sold. We generally assume they did not sell well because there just aren't many copies of them around today. And a record that sold really well, you expect to turn up a lot at antique shops and the like. I suppose it's also possible people just pitched them after the election is out of date. But the effect on the campaign is a bit of a mystery. Nobody, as far as I know, has really come up with a good answer to that one.
I guess last question for you, Patrick. Did you end up becoming more of a historian than you had intended to be? I know you have a website and maintain a lot of audio recordings and have worked with Archaeophone on other projects. But I guess you've gathered a sufficient amount of information about this campaign.
Well, yeah, I actually have a foot in both the phonograph and history. My MA was in history, so I'm trying to put it to good use.
Archaeophone Records has released Debate 08. What is next for the label, Richard? If there's anything else you want to talk about, or certainly we can mention too. We only have a couple of minutes left, but you won a Grammy just over a year ago and had a Grammy nomination earlier this year.
It's actually a total of four nominations for the label.
Four nominations and one win.
Right. In both of the last 2 years, we were nominated for Best Historical Album and for Best Album Notes. For Lost Sounds the first year, and the writer was Tim Brooks. And then this year for Actionable Offenses, and the writers were Patrick Feaster, who we're speaking with, and Dave Giovannone, the co-producer. So we lost in the writing category, but the first year we won for Best Historical Album. And we're hoping this one will have a shot too. Like you say, it's got extensive notes, transcripts of all the speeches, glorious color illustrations. It's a huge booklet. And so it's really more than just your typical CD. It's really a historical product, a historical document. And people can get it at www.archeophone.com. That's ARCHEOPHONE. Or they can call us at area code 217-355-9883.
What's next for the label?
We're working on a number of things. Sophie Tucker, her earliest recordings, we've been working on that for a long time, but it turns out they're very rare as well, so it's tough to find the best ones. We got to figure out what Patrick wants to write about next, because he's the best historian of the early industry that's out there, and we just love working with him.
Patrick, any thoughts on what you want to pursue next, or are you just constantly researching and something might pop up?
Oh, things are always turning up, and there's certainly plenty of wonderful CDs out there waiting to happen.
And there's the website that I can't put my finger on it right now that has some of your work on there.
Oh, my own website? It's phonozoic.net, phonozoic.net.
And can we keep up to speed on some of your projects through there?
That's the main portal for that.
All right. I want to thank both of our guests, Richard Martin from Archaeophone Records and collaborator Patrick Feaster over at Indiana University. Again, the CD is Debate 08. It's available from Archaeophone Records. And if you want a window into the past 100 years ago, check the CD out. Again, you can find out more about it at archaeophone.com. Thanks so much to both of you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.